Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Movie Geeks United on a Sunday night. I hope everyone out there has had a great weekend. I'm Jamie, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry.
Hey, what's up? How are you doing?
We're very excited to bring you the show. This is another crowded show we have. We have 8 guest interviews over the course of this show, and all tremendous filmmakers. It's an independent film spotlight. All of these are taking the indie world by storm, and whether it's on the festival circuit, on DVD, theatrical release, or what have you, it's a good representation of what's going on right now there, out there in the independent film world. How was your weekend, Jerry? Did you see any good? You saw The Soloist, right?
I saw The Soloist, which I liked, and you told me Kenneth Turan of the LA Times didn't like it, but I got to tell you, I think it's a pretty good movie. I don't think there's anything that Robert Downey Jr. can't do. He's pretty incredible. Jamie Foxx is good. It's actually a good movie, and I really think it speaks volumes about the morons at Universal Pictures to have shuttled this and focused on Revolutionary Road instead for the Oscars. And
right.
That was a really big mistake. I'm not saying like this would have been a strong Oscar contender. I think for Robert Downey Jr. it would have been, and for Jamie Foxx, I think the best actor category was already very crowded between the Mickey Rourke and Sean Penn. But I think this film had a chance. I would have put this film, maybe given it a best director and a best picture nomination for Joe Wright, who did Atonement and Pride and Prejudice as well. I would have shown him for some love with this film, because it didn't pay off for Revolutionary Road when it came up to the Oscars, except for Michael Shannon paid off.
Right.
He got the big kahuna. After all that, but as far as nominations go, but this is good. I also saw The Informers, which, has been just routinely just, battered to death, and it died a box office death, I think number 19.
Right.
I will say this. If you like Bret Easton Ellis, go see it. Especially if you like the book, go see it. If you don't, stay away, because you will walk out, as the couple in front of me did, 30 minutes into it. But if you like Bret Easton Ellis, go see it. I don't think it's the worst film ever made, which many...
glowing recommendation.
No, because this is... Obviously, I did not know this until last night. Many people think this is the worst film ever made. I don't think it's a great film by any stretch of the imagination. If you know the book and you know the characters, they are shallow, they are superficial, they are vapid, all that. But it's an interesting thing to watch unfold.
It's like a 1980s L.A. portrait.
1983. What's very interesting is that you've had, in the span of a week, 3 films that take place in the same time period in different locations. You have The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, based on Michael Chabon's book, that takes place also in 1983, but obviously in Pittsburgh. You have Limelight, which takes place in Long Island, which I want to say is maybe 81, 82, perhaps, and just 3 different, totally different films about the early 80s. Fascinating stuff.
What really struck me about this film, The Informers, outside of it being a Bret Easton Ellis 80s portrait of kind of privileged L.A., was the cast.
The cast is you got Mickey Rourke and Kim Basinger, who never appear at the same, on screen at the same time, but that's interesting. You have Billy Bob Thornton, which is, he plays a producer. But it's Mickey Rourke's character, and there are other characters too, and you'll forgive me, I don't know their names off the top of my head, but it's Mickey Rourke's character who plays a child kidnapper and child seller. And it's the scene where he snatches a kid off his skateboard that drove the couple in front of me to walk out.
Mm.
And it, the way it's done, you know, he's a very creepy character. This is not Randy the Ram Robinson. This is, this is a dude, this is a really creepy, scary guy that he plays.
That's interesting. It hadn't even occurred to me that this was a film with Rourke and Basinger in it.
Yeah, I didn't, until I watched it, I was like, wow, this is very interesting.
Yeah, but this was pre Mickey Rourke comeback, pre wrestler, when he was cast for this film.
Yeah,
yeah. So I'm sure it has a theatrical release, partly because they're hoping that gets somebody in. I read reviews of it, and they say that Mickey Rourke is probably one of the liveliest people in the bunch.
Yeah, and no. Well, Kim Basinger certainly isn't. She's, like, really comatose throughout the whole movie. Billy Bob Thornton, he's really thin in the movie. That's the thing that really struck me. He's really thin. But you know who else is in it? Is Winona Ryder.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's interesting. There's a scene where she goes into Cantor's delicatessen that is just, like, surreal, to say the least. And it's, you know, it's the standard Ellis characters that we've come to expect in a Los Angeles setting.
Right.
Obviously, this will be out on DVD in a couple of weeks because I don't see this thing sticking around. I mean, if the four people I saw with, the two of them left, is any indication, and then number 19 this morning on the weekend
box office, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, perhaps we'll talk some more about these new releases and some upcoming releases in between some of these interviews that we have. Let's get to the first segment here. These are a great bunch of guys, and this is a truly great movie. Deadline is a dark psychological short film. It's premiering in competition at this year's Tribeca Film Festival, and we have the pleasure of chatting with the film's producer-director, Joseph Backhash, writer-producer Sean McPhillips, and star Norman Reedus. And Joseph and Sean were actually colleagues at Miramax Films before they ventured out to start their own production company called Secret Hideout Films. And so far they've produced four short films, including last year's Tribeca premiere of Cupcake. And Norman, of course, he's a great actor. He is one of the most distinctive and intense actors out there. And his previous credits include Mimic, The Boondock Saints, and the sequel to Boondock Saints that we're finally about to see, and he talks a little bit about that. And Blade 2, he has a really impressive career. And Deadline plays this coming Wednesday the 29th, Friday May 1st, and Sunday May 3rd at Tribeca, and you can check TribecaFilm.com for showtimes. Here's the crew talking about Deadline. Enjoy, guys. I thought the movie was amazing, and I can't wait to talk to you about it. Oh, it was so good.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it was great. But usually the first question I ask is kind of a getting-to-know-you thing. What was the first film or filmmaker that inspired you to start in the business? Joseph, if you want to start with that.
Oh, wow, that's a tough one. But I guess I'd have to say David Lean.
Wow.
He's a personal favorite of mine, and Milos Forman and Francis Ford Coppola. Scorsese, George Lucas. I mean, the list of talented filmmakers that are inspirational are actually endless. But I think the first film that I saw that said, hey, I'd love to make films is a David Lean film.
Oh, you can't get better than that. I mean, they don't make those kinds of movies anymore. Those are terrific. Sean, how about you?
Well, for me, it was a combination of Star Wars was my first film that I was brought to in the movie theater. So it's George Lucas. And my dad was British, so he had me watching Benny Hill. So I have a combination of, big epic sci-fi movies, Spielberg movies, and then British comedies like Blackadder and Monty Python and things like that. And ultimately ended up, when I was a teenager, the things that really turned me on were stuff like A Clockwork Orange. So I always say I have my spin on it is a combination between Star Wars and A Clockwork Orange.
Wow. That's great. I've never heard Benny Hill before. Anytime I've asked that question, that's an original. Norman, how about you?
I think the first actor I ever saw that I really flipped out over was John Voight in Midnight Cowboy. It was like, I really loved that movie, and not just like the acting in it, but I like the way the movie is put together, the editing, the music, everything else. I think that character was just kind of hit me.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, Sean and Joseph, you guys were colleagues at Miramax, and you decided to venture out and start your own company called Secret Hideout Films. I'm wondering, Sean, maybe you can speak to this first. What clicked between the two of you?
Well, Joe and I actually met in a kung fu class. I was working at Miramax Films, and Joe was a stock market investor, and he had produced a film for a friend of his. So we actually met inside a kung fu class, and in the midst of doing kung fu, had a conversation about movies and realized we both loved films and that he had, you know, he had been producing for his friend. And I was like, well, I work at this place. Let's go watch some movies. And that just began a relationship that, you know, that's what we like to do. We just like to go see movies, you know? So ultimately I gave up that job to pursue creative filmmaking. And, and in the midst of that, Joe approached me and said, hey man, well, instead of doing all these, you know, just writing scripts and all this stuff, why don't you think about doing some shorts? Let's do this together. So I said, oh man, that's a great opportunity. So it really happened as a result of that. But it's all based on kung fu. It's all based on Chinese martial arts.
And Joe, tell me, what is your vision of Secret Hideout Films? What do you want its identity to be?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we want to be making feature films, and Sean is definitely the creative center of Secret Hideout Films. And, you know, I basically had, you know, made some money in the market and was using that capital to finance our productions. And as far as the type of films that we like to make, basically gritty films, comedy, stuff with edge and stuff that's really original. And I think we've sort of done that with all the projects we've done, you know, on the short side, and we definitely want to, you know, jump into the feature land.
Yeah.
Hopefully, Norman.
Yeah, man.
Ed Norman, you are wonderful. First of all, let me say I love what you do. Yeah, I think you're a hell of an actor.
Cool, thanks, bro.
And you're terrific in this film. Let me ask you, Sean, what was the genesis of this idea? How did this idea emerge for you for Deadline?
Well, Joe approached me and basically said, I have this concept for a film, and I want you to write the script for it. And he spelled out this situational, you know, scenario where a person had been abused and was tortured by it, and then we sort of find out that it's he kind of like, ultimately, in the beginning, he killed himself, and then we find out that he's actually back in this place. And so I saw it. I thought it was a really good idea, and just jumped on it. You know, like he told me about it, and really that was the genesis of it. Was Joe was sort of obsessed with this concept, so we just did it.
And Norman, what attracted you to it when you read it?
Well, my manager Kim Callahan at Roar, she sent it to me and said, you know, I think you should do this short. It's really good. And I was like, I don't want to do a fucking short. And then I read it, and I was like, wow, this is kind of fucking sick. And I just said, yeah. And then, you know, we got on set. You know, Joe has a very, you know, precise idea of what he wants, you know, to happen. And I don't know, everything just flowed really well. I was really happy I did it. And when I saw the final product, it was even better than I thought it would be. You know, I'm super stoked I did it.
Well, having worked in a lot of features, Norman, I'm wondering, is there a particular challenge to doing a short form film?
Well, I just think, like, you know, I mean, I've directed a few shorts, and I just think that, like, you know, if you just have 15 minutes to say something, you should say something. You know, it's like, and I've been a judge at a lot of festivals of shorts. So many of them are sort of like these light romantic comedies that just don't do anything. It's not, you know, worth the time. And I just think, you know, I mean, they treated this short like it was a feature. It really, you know, it wasn't just like everyone show up, we're going to shoot. It was like everything was down precise. I was really impressed that it was actually like a feature, you know.
Yeah.
It handled like a feature.
And so I would think one of the challenges would be you have a limited amount of time to convey, just like you're saying, convey an idea. I mean, that works for the acting side and the directorial and writing side, too, I'm sure. But what did you want to convey with this character? What was the most important thing for you?
Well, there's you know, when you watch it, we're in, when I'm hooked up to the chair, you know, I immediately start to play that, just like freaking the fuck out, you know, just shaking, flipping out. And we did that for a while. And then the next day, Joe came and he goes, you know what, just do it quiet. Just like move your eyes. And I kind of was like, you know, maybe what if we switch the two back and forth? And it was kind of a great idea, you know, for a second. And then I didn't quite understand what he was doing. And then I saw it and I was like, oh, that's what he was trying to do. And it was so Kubrick, you know, it was like a Stanley Kubrick moment. It was really kind of cool and quiet, and it made it scarier, you know.
It's haunting. Yeah, it's haunting, that those moments. Yeah.
A really good choice. And I just wanted it to be, you know, like, you know, you're in the jail cell and you get water thrown on you, you know, getting beat up. I just wanted to like really be like a wounded animal, you know, and you know, with the other stuff too, like, you know, realizing who's who and having like a little touch of, you know, a glorious moment when the girl walks in, the waitress, and it's kind of like, you know, add all these elements to it that fit nicely into a nice little package, you know, a little puzzle.
Yeah. And Joe, as a director, what were the challenges for you, particularly about this project Deadline? Because I've noticed that watching this movie, there's dozens and dozens of little moments and little tells that are so crucial to the story. I would imagine that was very important to you to convey those.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would say that the biggest challenge, without question, was time. You know, when you're shooting film independently, you're really running on the clock. But I can say that I was really blessed with world-class talent everywhere around me. I mean, starting with a great screenplay that Sean wrote and world-class actors. I mean, you know, Norman Reedus, Chris Mulkey, Phyllis Somerville, Sarah Jones. I mean, you don't typically get this caliber of cast for a short film. So a lot of the challenges that I think a lot of other filmmakers are sort of confronted by, I was able to, you know, sort of sidestep just because, again, we had a great script, talent, the actors sort of gravitated towards it. And from there, I mean, we had an unbelievable cinematographer, Luke Geist-Bueller, and a phenomenal production designer, Rick Gilbert. And it was really recreating this world that didn't necessarily exist because we built a lot of those sets. I mean, the lethal injection room, the isolation room, and the bathroom. So insofar as we were doing that, we were creating, this sort of special place for our main character. But again, I'd say the biggest obstacle was just getting our days and getting all the footage that we needed in the allotted time.
Yeah, but even so, you guys shot at a practical locations as well, like an actual prison you shot in?
Yeah, we did actually shoot. There were two practical locations. The diner, and that's where we were. Both the diner and the prison were actually where the clock was really ticking. In the diner's case, we were, you know, we're shooting off hours, so we didn't have a lot of money to pay these guys, but they were letting us shoot in the evening, and we had to be out of there by 5 o'clock. So we were really shooting against, shooting against the sunrise. Once the sun started to come up, I mean, we were toast. And we were shooting in the summer, so we didn't have a lot to work with there. And then as far as the prison goes, this is a prison out in Nassau County, and they didn't have a production in there. I think the last time they had a production in there, I should say, was about 30 years ago for a film. And they basically said you have, like, 4 hours in here. And I don't even know why they gave it to us. it was a real lucky sort of scenario where we had a great location scout, and he was very persistent. And they gave us those 4 hours. But, you know, again, it's all we needed.
Yeah. And I was so impressed by every element of the movie, the songs that were used. The cinematography is incredible. It's just a wondrous-looking movie. And Sean, tell me about the decision, because this is your, if I'm not mistaken, your fourth short under Secret Hideout Films. And they've all been 35 millimeter. I would think that would be an intentional decision on your part.
Yeah, well, we did a short film that was more of a sort of black and white thing shot in an apartment that was 60 millimeter. Cupcake was the one that was in Tribeca last year that was 35 millimeter. Deadline was 35 millimeter. And the one after that, The Cubicle, was shot on like a very, very high-end HD format.
Okay.
And basically, that was mainly a conversation with Joe, you know, being the financier, you know, what format we could afford, what, you know, who we were going to be working with, and, you know, how we could deal with them to cut their rates and all that type of stuff, and what kind of equipment we could get based on that budget and things like that. So I was probably not super inclusive on that. You know, I wasn't like my decision or anything. I think it was mainly a conversation with Joe and saying what's appropriate for this format. Obviously, for Deadline, it's a very gritty piece. It's, you know, it needs to be the contrast and the image needs to be a certain thing. And I think that at one point we were considering digital just for budget's sake, but ultimately this was like a baby. So it was like the kind of thing where, you know what, it really, really needs to have that 35 millimeter look, and it definitely was the right choice.
Yeah, majorly. And I want to, you mentioned Cupcake at Tribeca last year, and obviously you're at Tribeca this year with Deadline. I want to ask all of you about the film festival experience, how you guys personally experience the film festival experience and its value to you as creative people. Joe, if you want to start with that.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I can tell you just from, you know, sort of bouncing around other film festivals with Cupcake, Tribeca is, it's really a top-notch festival, and it's really good to its filmmakers in terms of events and content that they select. So, you know, from last year to this year, they've gotten more competitive, I think, in terms of streamlining the number of films that they're taking. But, I mean, other than that, it's just been a great place to meet other filmmakers, and it is really great momentum for our project. Once a film lands at Tribeca, it's sort of like the rest of the festival circuit takes note of it, and I've seen it already. There have already been a lot of inquiries about Deadline simply based on its acceptance to Tribeca, and I think that says something about the quality and caliber of the festival, that it's sort of a, you know, a trendsetter for people to follow.
Yeah. Sean, what do you enjoy most about the film festival experience?
Well, I once worked for Miramax Films, and I worked as an acquisitions person, so I went to all these film festivals, and I was on the other side of the desk for, you know, many, many years, and I always wanted to be on this side, you know, and that first call to say, by the way, Cupcake is in Tribeca, was like one of the best calls I've ever received in my life, and basically it changed our lives, because for example, we had that project, and we really, really wanted it to get into the festival. And when it did, we, you know, we had this piece of work, and that was the way we, that was kind of what we used to talk to casting agents when we were casting for Deadline. And that was the only way that we were able to get something to Norman Reedus to say, here's something that appeared in this festival. So for him to understand that we're not just, you know, somebody with a video camera in the backyard, but that we're people who have successfully shot something, built something, and we had it go into a major festival. He's not going to take a meeting and, you know, with someone unless, you know, well, I'm not speaking for him, but like, you know, someone of his, you know, level is not going to talk to some random people, even if they have a halfway decent script. So it's like, if that just helped us on every level, being in the festival, being able to speak to the casting person, and having them say, hey, meet with this person, and then being able to meet with that person, it opened a couple of doors for us in that way. My former boss, Harvey Weinstein, saw Cupcake. He sent me a message and said he liked it, and that meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just a great sort of thing, like, wow, he heard about it, you know? And so this time around, getting in and having half the shorts that were in it last year, it was, we felt like doubly honored, but also because this is a narrative and because we have actors of this caliber in the movie this time, and having Norman and Chris and all these people in the film, and having it be more of a narrative piece. Cupcake was more of a sort of musical comedy. It was a kind of a silent film, whereas this is much more bracing for a feature. A lot of people are paying more attention to it at Tribeca, enabling us to be able to go out to agents and go out to people and getting more press, and as a result of the cast and the fact that we're returning filmmakers. So it speaks volumes, and it's actually the best thing that's happened to us in the film world is being a part of this festival. I mean, we've been doing lots of other festivals, but this one is the one that's sort of like you're screening at real venues. They're taking care of you. It's really a great festival.
Yeah, those are the filmmaker-friendly festivals are amazing. And Norman, I'm sure that you've attended many festivals. I'm assuming with your tremendous career. Tell me about the interaction with the actual moviegoers. Is that enjoyable to you?
Yeah, it's always enjoyable. It's I mean, you're always appreciative when somebody likes what you do. You know, I have been to a lot of film festivals for a long time now, and they're all good. You know, but even the tiniest of them are fun. But when you actually meet the people that are, you know, the audience, it's really nice when they like your stuff, for sure.
This is a terrific film, and it's in competition this year at Tribeca, and I know it's a big favorite, and it deserves to be. Before I let you guys go, let me ask about future projects. Norman, I know you have several movies in the pipeline that are waiting release. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those?
Yeah, I have a film called Pandorum, shot by Christian Albert. It's sort of a sci-fi movie. It's with Ben Foster and Dennis Quaid. And then I have the sequel to The Boondock Saints, All Saints Day, coming out, which we just wrapped. I actually left the set of Deadline and went and shot both those simultaneously. So, and then just finished a film in Bulgaria right before that, so I was a little out of it a lot of the times, but they kept me in check. And then I have a feature film with Donald Sutherland cast so far called When September Ends that I'm doing with my production company Big Bald Head and my partner Karen Cohen out of Los Angeles, and I'll be directing that one.
Wow. Wow. This is
that's
exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And Sean and Joe, whoever would like to speak to this, you obviously want to get into feature filmmaking with your company. What are the prospects there? What are some future projects that you guys are eyeballing?
Well, we went to a meeting once where Harvey Weinstein was just like speaking in an audience, and he's just like, you know, pick up the pen, you know. So it just ultimately had been writing a bunch of stuff this year, and so when we finished the last short, we just went into sort of hibernation writing mode. We've got kind of a horror adventure that has one draft in it that we're doing another draft of. We have a psychological comedy that has three drafts on it. We've got, we shot a trailer for something that we hope to expand into a feature that we were in development on. So, like, there's sort of no end to the ideas, and we're currently developing, like, several feature screenplays, but we love all formats. We have ideas for television. We love webisodes. I mean, I honestly think we love everything. We want to work in all formats. So right now it's just a matter of, after this festival and the grind that we're dealing with the festival and all the sort of talking to press and talking to agents, talking to all these people, just a light on a couple of projects that move us further in the direction of being able to raise the kind of financing or interest in our feature projects that we really want to put together. So that's our plan.
Well, you guys are incredible, and you've made an incredible film with Deadline, and I wish you guys the best of luck, and I thank you so much, all of you, for doing this with us today.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Very pleasurable. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, man.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, the film is called Deadline. It's a short film, a psychological thriller. It premieres at Tribeca this year on Wednesday night, and it's very good. I've watched it several times, and it's for 15 minute or so short. It's
right.
It's very twisty-turvy. It keeps you guessing, and it has
that's good
atmosphere in abundance. It's beautifully photographed and very well acted. So I'm excited about that film, and I think it is a favorite in the competition there.
Well, that's
at
good.
Tribeca.
That's
yeah,
good. It sounded like they had a lot of fun making, and they had a lot of fun with the whole experience. So that's cool to hear. Yeah.
Yeah, and the tweeting birds in the background. Norman was calling in from a wedding. I think he took a break from a wedding.
Okay.
I don't think he was the groom, but I'm hoping not anyway. Okay, let's get to our next guest. This is an incredibly talented guy. Our next guest is a multi-talented writer, producer, director, and actor whose works include the screenplays for Small Soldiers and Mouse Hunt, as well as his own directorial efforts, including The Chase, Detroit Rock City, Welcome to Hollywood, and Night at the Golden Eagle. His latest film, Look, examines the world of hidden surveillance cameras, a world that finds Americans captured without their knowledge at least 170 times every day. It picked up the grand jury prize at the 2007 CineVegas International Film Festival, and you can pick it up on DVD starting Tuesday, May 5th. It is a pleasure to welcome to Movie Geeks United Mr. Adam Rifkin. Mr. Rifkin.
Hello.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Welcome.
I'm great. How you doing?
Good.
I'm terrific. Thanks so much for doing the show today. I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem.
You have the most incredible versatile resume, and I want to get into how you broke into the business. But first of all, tell me, when you were growing up, movies had to have been a major part of your life. What were those movies that inspired you starting out?
Well, movies were my whole life growing up. I loved them ever since I can remember. And the first movies that I loved were monster movies. And I was turned on to monster movies. I was probably about four when my grandfather bought me a copy of a magazine which was popular at the time called Famous Monsters of
Oh, you had that bug too, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh yeah, we wasted a lot of money on that magazine.
Exactly. So I was obsessed with Frankenstein, Dracula, The Wolfman, The Blob, all the old monster movies.
Right.
I loved them. And that eventually evolved into a love of all kinds of movies. I remember, you know, because as, you know, like any kid, in addition to liking monster movies, I also liked Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and kid movies too. Yeah. But I remember the first movie that had an emotional impact on me, a movie that made me feel like film wasn't just for entertainment, but could actually change the way you think about the world, change the way you look at the world, was when I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
And it just blew me away. I had no idea that film could be this impactful and this powerful. And that's what kind of started me on this just sort of journey of loving film as an art form as well as just an entertainment.
How old were you when you saw that film?
I saw it when it came out. I think it came out in 78.
Okay.
I think. So I was born in 66, last day of 66. So,
see, I saw it. That was the movie that changed my life. And I saw it when I was about 13.
Right.
Yeah, okay, I was about 11 or 12. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so ironic. That's great. We're kindred spirits here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how did you start to manifest that passion that you had for movies? I know that, did you start out as a cartoonist at first, or how did that happen? How did that work?
Well, I'd always been a cartoonist just for fun. You know, that's just always been kind of a hobby of mine. But movies, from the time I was probably about eight, I had my father's home movie camera, and I was just making movies with my friends for my entire childhood constantly. That's all I did growing up. So I drove everybody crazy because that's all I wanted to do. And all the while, I just figured that, you know, I'd make movies for fun growing up, and then when I was old enough, I'd move to Los Angeles and learn how to make movies for real. And what I didn't realize at the time was that I was actually teaching myself the principles of real movie making. You know,
right,
I kind of
right.
figured out editing and figured out master shots and coverage and figured all that stuff out just by having fun. So when I got out to California, I was really pleased to find out that making real movies is not that different from making movies in the backyard. You just have more money and more help.
Right, right.
That's
the same principles apply.
Yeah.
But you went to, did you go to school in Chicago before moving out to L.A.?
I wouldn't recommend this to anybody, but I go to college. I actually used USC as a means of getting from Chicago to L.A. I enrolled in the, I didn't get accepted into the film school because my grades in high school weren't good enough. So I just enrolled in the liberal arts program, and I dropped out after a semester. I just kind of used college as a way of getting to California quicker, and it went down easier for my parents that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So you got yourself out there, and it was like you found a way, an anchor.
Exactly. Once
right.
I got here, putting down roots and writing scripts and just knocking on doors and trying to find money to get my movies made, because I figured out pretty early the only difference between making a movie and not making a movie, there's no magic to it, is money. to
right.
sneak it with. So
yeah.
I just started looking for money, you know.
Yeah.
That's probably the best advice, the best story I've ever heard. You really cut out the middleman pretty quickly with the, because you already had the skills. You didn't need
the
skills.
I like to think I taught myself a lot of the skills growing up along the way. Yes, obviously I'm all, you know, every movie I make I'm learning so much more.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of the basics, I had kind of figured those out as I went along growing up.
Yeah. This is interesting. Tell me how this happened, if what I read was correct. At 21, you had written a screenplay for Planet of the Apes that attracted the studio's attention?
Actually, this is how it went down. I made my first movie when I was about, I guess I was about 19 or 20. It was called Never on Tuesday.
Right.
It was a little independent film, but it had a big cast of characters, thanks to the producer who I work with still to this day. He produced that movie, named Brad Wyman.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up with a lot of these guys out here who, at that time, and still to this day, many of them are very, very famous. Charlie Sheen was in it, Nicolas Cage was in it, Emilio Estevez was in it, Judd Nelson, Cary Elwes, right off of Princess Bride. All these guys did cameos because they knew Brad, right? And I had met them through Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this hot little independent movie that I was convinced was going to make me rich and famous at 20 years old, right?
Right.
We screened it for all of the distributors to sell it. They all wanted to buy it. But the only one that the financier would sell it to was Paramount, because
mm-hmm.
they made a deal with him where they would take the video rights and they gave him the theatrical rights himself to release the movie himself, and they also gave him $2 million with which to release the movie through his own theatrical company called Palisades Entertainment. What they didn't know is Palisades Entertainment didn't exist. It was a scam, and he ripped them off for another $2 million, and the movie never got released theatrically, right, which was a bitter pill to swallow. But having screened that film for all the studios, Fox had seen it, right? So I got to meet with the president of Fox, and he said, you know, it's like one of these kind of meetings. I like your style, kid. What do you want to do next? You know, that kind of thing. And I said, I really want to bring back the Planet of the Apes franchise, and I pitched my version of how I would want to do it, which basically would be, in a nutshell, it's a sequel to the first film, where you open the movie with the last scene from the first movie, where Charlton Heston realizes he's on Earth, he's screaming up at the Statue of Liberty, cut to black, right?
Right.
And then a card comes up and says, 300 years later, and when you fade in, the apes had reached their Roman era, and now basically we do Spartacus with apes, where the humans are the slaves, and one of them mounts a revolt against the oppressive Roman apes, right?
Okay. So James Franciscus never shows up to rescue Taylor.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And here's it was an incredible whirlwind ride. I wrote the script. I turned it in. They loved it. They said, we're going to start pre-production next week. Their only note on the script was, can you trim it down about 10 pages? We had Rick Baker on board to do the apes. We
right.
had Danny Elfman on board to do the score. It was either going to be Tom Cruise or Charlie Sheen to be the guy.
Oh, gosh.
And at that time, those guys were neck and neck in terms of who was going to be, you know, who was going to be the biggest star, right?
Right.
So I thought, yet again, holy crap, I'm going to be rich and famous at 21 years old, right?
Yeah.
The next day, I kid you not, this is not a plot from a movie, this really happened, the head of the studio was fired, and the project was shelved.
That's a lot better than the Tim Burton remake we were stuck with right there. I mean, I'll tell you that right now.
Well, it changed hands many times. After my version was put on the shelf, it then went to Oliver Stone, and then
I remember that.
And then Chris Columbus, and then James Cameron, and then Tim Burton. And by the time Tim Burton's version got finished, even though there were similarities to my original script, it was different enough that I didn't get credit. And
It something occurs to me. We've just been talking for 10 minutes, and you have discussed so many different styles of films. And you look at your resume, and it's so incredibly versatile. I'm wondering what kinds of stories generally interest you.
Well, I love all kinds of stories and all kinds of movies. And I've been fortunate in that I've been able to get an opportunity to tell all different kinds of movies, like you know, whether, you know, I mean, Look, which I know we're going to talk about, is very much an independent drama.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time that I made Look, I got an opportunity to write Underdog for Disney, right? Which couldn't be more different, right? Now, it's been great in you know, creatively for me, because I get to flex different muscles with different projects. But it's also, you know, as much as it's been a blessing, it's also been a curse, because Hollywood likes to put you in a very easily, you know, identifiable box. And, you know, if somebody's the comedy guy, it's very easy to see that person as the go-to comedy guy. And or if somebody's the thriller guy or the horror guy. The fact that I've done lots of different things, though I crave it and I wouldn't have it any other way, it has been a hindrance in my career throughout the years.
Yeah, because you can't be pigeonholed. They don't know where to put you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about Look. Was there an aha moment when something struck you and the seeds of this idea took hold?
Yes. I had gotten a ticket from a red light camera in Los Angeles. And I had gone through the light, apparently, during the day, because I don't remember the flash going off. And the ticket came in the mail to my house, and there was a picture of me running the light that came along with the picture. I mean, came along with the ticket, right?
Right, right.
And I thought to myself, this is unnerving that somebody took my picture without my knowledge.
Right.
You know, very embarrassing expression, right? And sends it to my home address.
Mm-hmm. So
then I just started to think, how many other cameras are catching me on any given day without my knowledge? I just decided to start paying attention. And, you know, obviously everybody knows there's a camera in an ATM machine or in a bank or whatever. But I was shocked at just how many of them there are everywhere. Every time I would look around, there would be another one or two or three. And it started to creep me out and made me feel a little paranoid. And then I started to think, well, who's behind the, you know, who's on the other side of all these lenses? Who's watching all this footage? Where is this footage ending up? Then I did a little research, and I found out that actually the statistic is over 200 times a day the average American is captured on surveillance camera, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought to myself, this could be an interesting way to make a movie. I'd never seen before a movie entirely shot with surveillance cameras. What if a filmmaker had access to every piece of surveillance footage over the course of a week in a city?
Mm-hmm.
And could cut together the most interesting stories that happened that week, you know, from camera to camera to camera. And that was the idea. That's how the idea kind of hatched.
So what kind of locations did you choose to explore where there might be a hidden camera?
Well, some of the obvious ones are obviously the mall and the department store, the street corner cameras, bus cameras, things like that. But what a lot of people don't know is that in 37 states, it's legal to have hidden cameras in dressing rooms and to have hidden cameras in public bathrooms, which is a little bit, you know.
Really?
Weird.
Very unnerving, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you this. This is interesting. When we were researching the movie, I went to a bunch of different mall security offices just to kind of, you know, I figured malls are a good place to go because they have so many cameras and so many monitors and it was either that or a casino, and I didn't have a casino as close as I had a mall, so I went to the mall.
Right.
You would think, or at least I thought, for whatever reason, that the people manning these cameras must be trained professionals, right? They must be very responsible individuals who take their job seriously. I found it, in some instances, not to be the case. They were high school kids. They were zooming in on girls' boobs all day long. They were smoking pot, and you know,
it's
it was
Observe and Report.
It's literally like Observe and Report, right? And so they would have a code. A guy on the floor with the walkie would make, you know, give a code if a hot girl walked into a particular door in the mall, and then the guys in the surveillance office would follow her from camera to camera to camera all through the mall all day long. If she happened to bend over and they caught a glimpse of her skirt, they would put it on their highlight reel, right? If something was particularly embarrassing or humiliating, they'd post it on YouTube anonymously.
When
I realized this is a movie I have to make right now.
It also sort of coincides with that thing we saw a couple of weeks ago with the Domino's employees who recorded themselves, you know, videotaped themselves, putting all the stuff in their pizza and everything.
Yeah.
And then they put it on YouTube and they got fired. And I bet they wondered, hey, why'd we get fired?
Yeah.
But even so, you're using this surveillance camera framework for this film, how far were you able to take that conceit? Were there limitations involved at all for you as a director? Did it take some extra work to get some variance in there?
Well, I thought foolishly going in that this is going to be the easiest movie I'd ever made.
Right.
I thought, okay, we put one camera in that corner, one camera in that corner. The actors are mic'd. They walk in, they say their lines a few times. We're done by lunch, right? Turned out not to be the case. Yes, the biggest restrictions were that I only would put cameras where real surveillance cameras actually were,
mm-hmm.
or would be. I didn't cheat at all. So anytime you see every single camera in the movie is real. I mean, it's not a real surveillance camera, but it's really where a camera is or would be. And we had a security expert on the film as well the whole time to make sure that we were very accurate about where the cameras were placed.
Yeah.
So there's no creativity in the camera moves to tell the story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to, you know, if you want to draw attention to the poison glass of milk, you can push in on the glass of milk, you can whip pan to the, you know, the guy wringing his hands waiting for the other guy to take a sip. Couldn't do any of that.
Hmm.
So it really all became about performance and blocking.
Right.
And I didn't realize how difficult that was going to be until
mm-hmm.
I got into the thick of it. It was really, really challenging, but really rewarding, too, because it had to feel like real surveillance footage. I think that the actors that we got really were able to pull off the reality, and I think it feels really real. And when we would do Q&A screenings, when it came out theatrically and it played around the country for the first half of last year, we traveled around with it too. The audience, the biggest compliment I got was when the audience would say, somebody in the audience would say, how much was real and how much did you fake?
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we faked it all, but it was a great compliment.
Well, you have traveled film festivals with Look, and I mentioned the CineVegas Award, which is fantastic. What is their reaction to the film? I would think that they would be kind of unnerved.
Here's what's interesting. I'll tell you what's funny. People definitely, I always saw it as a drama, you know.
Right, right.
But I really had no idea that it was going to shake people up as much as it did, because people are very affected by being forced to be voyeurs
mm-hmm.
in very uncomfortable situations.
That's true.
And it really worked out great, because one of my biggest fears going into it was, how are we going to, especially being a character drama, how are we going to care about these characters if we don't have close-ups? How are we going to, is it going to feel too cold, you know?
Right.
Is it going to feel too removed? Turns out that's exactly what helps it work more on the subconscious, I think, and make it more disturbing, is that the audience isn't vicariously living out the adventure with George Clooney, you know, or, you know, you're not, you know, instead of being James Bond when you're watching a James Bond movie, you know, it's fun to be the hero.
Mm.
You're deliberately forced to be on the outside of the movie looking in. You're looking in on people doing things that
mm-hmm.
they don't know are being filmed, and it makes you feel like you're an accomplice to something
right.
illicit.
Right.
And so, interestingly enough, though, the audiences were, at the end of the movies, whenever we would screen them, the Q&As were always divided right down the middle. About half the audience felt, well, I think the more cameras, the better in society, because the more cameras mean the safer the society is going to be, and I will gladly forgo some of my civil rights for a safer society.
Right.
The other half of the audience will say, this is George Orwell's nightmare come true. This is
yeah.
an invasion of privacy. It doesn't make it a safer society.
Yeah. And you hear stuff like mayors and stuff like bragging, especially in Chicago, we're going to have cameras on every street corner. I mean,
exactly.
Do you really want to live in a society like that?
Well,
yeah, and that's a hot topic, and especially on the heels of this previous administration, that was a very hot topic, the lack of privacy, or we have to give up some of our civil rights for the greater good.
And people wanting to go along with that.
Where does it end? I mean,
yeah.
do you see a limit to this at all?
I don't, and I think that it's just going to get more and more, you know, ubiquitous. I mean, since we made the movie, there are, you know, the number of times that the average American is captured is way above 200 now. And not to mention the fact that every computer has a webcam. So you basically got a camera in your house. You know, there is software that can tap into everybody's home webcam. You know, everybody's cell phone camera, everybody's camcorder. There's cameras everywhere, and it's interesting because I don't think any of us realize what voyeurs we all ultimately really are and what exhibitionists we all ultimately are, you know?
I just want to backtrack just a little bit. There's a film you made a couple years ago I really like, Night at the Golden Eagle.
Thank you.
And, no, I really, it's one of the first films I saw when I lived out in Los Angeles for a year, and I was just curious, just listening to the interview and your early experiences in Hollywood, I was just curious, how much of your early experiences informed that film? Because it's a very bleak view of Hollywood, to say the least.
Thanks. Actually, it's interesting. I wrote that film when I was pretty early on in Los Angeles, and then ultimately got a chance to make it years later. I wouldn't say that the life lessons that I'd learned, you know, like the Planet of the Apes experience and like the, you know, my first film not getting theatrically released, I don't think those really informed that, had anything to do with what made me be so nihilistic with that script.
Right.
I don't know, you know, I think a lot of where the inspiration for that kind of nihilism comes from some of the movies that I loved as I was really becoming a student of film, and I sort of just fell in love with these character dramas from the 70s.
Right,
you know?
Right, okay, yeah. Right.
And, you know, those, I mean, as much as the happy Hollywood ending has become the absolute norm in movies today.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, basically killing off the hero was the norm, you know?
Right.
And I just loved, I always found that a depressing movie made me think, you know, and I guess it all kind of goes back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that, you know, that really, you know, tragic ending. You know, those are the kinds of movies that always made me walk away thinking about life and thinking about, you know, thinking philosophically, as opposed to, you know, so many movies where you get up and the first thing you think is, okay, where should we eat, you know?
Sadly, that's true of a lot of movies, but there are some you see that still are released today that do have that, like, I wouldn't say utterly bleak, but, you know, they have an ending that's realistic enough that you can relate to.
Definitely. No, yeah. There's still a lot of really impactful movies that are made. And by the way, that said, I love Hollywood movies and I love popcorn movies.
Right.
I just love the movie experience. I mean, I saw 17 again the other day. I thought it was good. You know what I mean? I was thoroughly entertained. So I like all kinds of movies.
Right.
Well, looking back through your career and everything that you've done, how do you feel as a filmmaker that you've matured?
Well, you know, I just feel like every movie I make, I learn so much more about how to make movies. And every time I finish a movie, I want to start it again. I always feel like, okay, now that I'm done, I've now learned a better way of how to make this movie. I want to remake it all over again, you know? So
yeah.
Right.
I think the more experiences I have, and as time goes on and the more opportunities I get, the more I learn that I don't know anything yet, you know? And I just want to keep learning. I just want to keep watching movies. I want to learn from the masters, and I also want to learn from, you know, new filmmakers, because sometimes a fresh approach to something suddenly is thoroughly inspiring, you know? So I'd say, yeah, the biggest thing I've learned is I need to just keep learning and learning.
Wow. Well, we love what you do, and we appreciate your time very much. And
yes,
Look comes out on DVD May 5th, so go pick it up. Adam, thank you so much for your time tonight. You've been great. Come back anytime.
I'd love to. Thank you guys so much.
No
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Adam Rifkin. The movie is Look on DVD Tuesday, May 5th. It's a great conversation. He's a really interesting
guy. I like him.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, time for our next guest. This, no time to lose. We have a packed show tonight.
Right.
You've heard about this movie, Anvil, the story of Anvil?
Yeah, I've heard of it. And our good friend Aaron interviewed these guys. And this movie looks really, really funny. And it definitely speaks to my high school and early college years. Big heavy metal fan. So
your metal years?
Oh, my metal years. Some would say they're still there, but not as they once were, but yeah, this should be a lot of fun. I'm actually, you know, here's some trivia for you.
Okay.
I may be in a famous documentary called Heavy Metal Parking Lot. I don't
really?
Know. I've only watched it once. And I didn't even, and I looked for me, but I can't find me. But it's a Judas Priest concert here in Maryland at the Capitol Center in 1986, the first concert I ever went to. And I may be in this documentary. I need to watch this again. I haven't seen it in a long time, and really like freeze frame it and look to see if I'm anywhere in there.
Well, that's a lot more prestigious than the movie I'm in about killer monkeys in a laboratory with Rowdy McDowell and Christopher Atkins. That's my claim to fame.
Okay.
But this film, Anvil, for anyone out there that doesn't know, it's a new documentary about this heavy metal group, Anvil. And back in the early 80s, they were primed to be one of the biggest in the music industry. They were a great band. Everyone, all the legends of that genre of music, praised Anvil. But for one reason or another, bad producers, what have you, marketing, what have you, they never found their way to glory. And they've struggled ever since, but their dream has never died. And so now they're middle-aged, and they're fighting for a second chance. And this is a movie that people have really taken close and personal to them. It's a great kind of triumphant movie about the creative spirit, but also never giving up on your dream. I think that's what people are responding to more than anything. And it's playing in theaters across the country, and it's going to open wider and wider. You can read more about it at Anvil, thestoryofanvil.com. But for right now, enjoy this interview we have with, I don't have the screen up, with who we're interviewing. Do you have our screen up at all?
Yeah, I do. Let's see.
I should know
band
this.
Members Rob Reiner and Steve Lipskudlow.
Yeah. These are a couple of great guys. So enjoy this interview. Here it is.
What was the first record, album of any genre, doesn't have to be metal, that made an impression on you all? Lips, why don't you go first?
First album that made an impression on me?
Yeah.
Beatles' Rubber Soul.
Really?
And what? Rolling Stones' December's Children.
Wow. And what was it about that album? When do you remember hearing it, and was there a song in particular?
I really liked the album. It wasn't really one song in particular. I guess Get Off of My Cloud.
Right. And what about you, Rob?
I'd say it was probably the first Black Sabbath album, or Deep Purple Machine Head, or any Hendrix or Cream album.
When y'all heard these records, were you all, did y'all already know you wanted to be musicians, or was it just at the time, you loved music and then later on got into musicianship?
I kind of started playing drums already after having liked listening to hard rock.
Was there a drummer that, you wanted to model yourself on, or that you're like, my drummer?
I am actually modeled after many great players. I just won't tell you who.
But why don't I name you a couple of drummers? And you tell me what your impressions are, or if you want to abstain.
We did this with Carmen Appice.
I did this with Carmen Appice. Sure, throw it at me.
Okay. Well, I'll do the obvious. Ringo Starr.
Puts me to sleep.
Okay. Okay. Charlie Watts.
Even more lethargic.
Okay. All right. I'll throw this last two at you, and I'm just throwing these because these are kind of the standard that everyone kind of talks about. Levon Helm from the band.
Not familiar with it at all.
Okay. Well, Lips, what about you? When you heard that first Stones record, did you already know you wanted to be a musician, or were you just into music and then later on you said, I want to be a musician?
I think it was around the same period of time that I got my guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was once I, started listening to guitar music, I always wanted to own a guitar. And so, but for whatever reason, that particular album stood out to me because it was kind of hard-edged.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about when you two first met. Who met who?
Well, I met Rob at a jam session that my friend that I had in my biology class set up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 16 and Rob was 14.
What about that initial meeting? Had you two, you know,
well,
y'all connected?
Well, right straight away we were started playing Black Sabbath songs, and in fact, what was most remarkable, the guy who invited us to the jam was also a guitar player, and within about 10 minutes he sat down on the couch and stopped bothering because Rob and I had gone up, just went off on a tangent of playing all kinds of stuff. But even more remarkably is we began creating music right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd just start playing a riff and Rob would pound out beats, and it was amazing. It's like instant songwriting.
Right.
I'd never done that before. It was the first guy that had ever been able to sort of follow what I was doing. And Marty, the guy who was sitting on the couch, was freaking out because he couldn't believe that we were creating this music right there. He thought it must be somebody else's song, but it was not somebody else's song. It was a song we were making up right there. So it was quite amazing then.
Well, and y'all two hit it off, and I guess y'all said, you know, we should start a band. Was that basically what happened?
That's right. You know, walking down the street, well, we should just make a band. We said, yeah.
How did y'all come upon the name of Anvil for y'all's band?
Well, initially we were called Lips, and then when we got signed to our first record deal, the label insisted that we change the name because they didn't want to have any people getting confused by the band Lips Incorporated.
Okay.
And they wanted something that sounded a lot more metal, like our sound was, you know?
Right, right.
So one night in a hotel room, I jotted down a bunch of names on a piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
and we picked Anvil.
Hmm. But now let's talk a little, I guess, about that first album, which, you know, in the documentary, there's that great prologue with, you know, Lars, Metallica, Lemmy, and Scott Ian, and everyone, and they're all talking about when they first heard Metal on Metal. And so what was that, the process of writing that album and when it first came out? I guess when did it come out? I believe it was 19, am I right? 1980?
1982. Okay.
1982. And so what was the process of that album, of you finding someone who was willing to produce y'all's first record?
What do you
think?
The thing was we were really years ahead of our time.
Right.
At that particular time in history, and when those kind of things happen, you generally don't know that that's what's going on, because you do it out of innocence. You know, a riff is a riff. It's what is the drummer doing that makes that riff come across differently? And what we did is we took, you know, 16th and 32nd beats and put bass drum beats behind each of those.
Mm-hmm.
Creating this double bass drum style of playing fast.
Mm-hmm.
What might have been played with one bass drum, like a song like Highway Star, we're playing it with two bass drums and playing the guitar riff twice as many beats per to the riff.
Right.
Same general tempo, except that you're playing twice as fast, thusly creating speed metal.
Mm-hmm.
But to us, it was our way of, it was our way.
Right.
Our kind of way. And when we did it, it was completely out of innocence. All the other bands came and copied it and called it their own, but, I mean, that's the way it goes, you know?
Right.
But as being the guys that kind of somewhat helped start that, it's, you know, the truth is being divulged now.
Right.
Well, it's kind of good.
Well, yeah, that opening prologue is, I guess, when you go back and you think about that opening prologue of the documentary, I guess it must be kind of heartening for you and Rob to hear these guys, you know, Lars, Lynn.
Amazing, man.
It's great, man.
That's great stuff. And these guys aren't paid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, with musicians, what it really comes down to is if my favorite bands are obscure, okay? They're never the stuff that musicians the musicians groove on is the stuff that most people just never hear about.
Right.
And we're one of those bands, mm-hmm. you know? It's like Captain Beyond. Do you know who Captain Beyond is? Probably not, but we love that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Budgie, another band. I mean, there's an endless
Cactus.
List. Cactus. Most people don't know who Cactus were.
Right.
And they were they predated Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you had this, you know, this moment in the 80s, you know, and then you became, I guess, you know, one would say you became working musicians, which are, you know, where you had the day job, but then you had the night gigs and the weekend gigs, and then you had families and so forth, and always putting out the records and, you know, hoping that maybe this record will break through. But then the documentary comes along, the opportunity for the documentary. And so how did that come about? What was the pitch to you guys that, you know, someone wants to make a documentary about Anvil?
Well, it wasn't just a someone. It was a fan.
Right.
So, and it's not just a stroke of luck. It's a stroke of fate.
Mm-hmm.
We met this fan by the name of Sasha Gervasi back in 1982, the first time we went to England.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, he ended up becoming a roadie and becoming very close friends with us. He went on with his life, became a screenwriter for Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon after he did that, he contacted us in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
We got together. He realized that Anvil hadn't stopped. We never quit. We kept on recording and touring and being who we are. And it was like, it seemed like a really compelling story that these two guys who had met from the time they were 14, 15 years old are now in their 50s, still doing this and still believing in their hearts that one day they were going to be rock stars.
Right.
And if not rock stars, then at least that they were enjoying their lives. And this is something to be admired and shown to the world.
Right. Well, and what was, you know, they always talk about in documentary filmmaking, that there's always this issue of trust. There must be trust between the documentarian and the subject that they're documenting. And so I'm wondering, on that level, what the trust was in that, you know, there's a couple of scenes in the documentary, particularly.
Okay, you have to understand, this is a dear friend,
mm-hmm.
and we gave him 100% access.
You're never
going to see this kind of thing ever again.
Right.
No one would ever, I don't know anybody that would reveal the things that we let get revealed. I'm not sorry that they were revealed. They were pertinent to making a compelling dramatic story, and I think that it was brilliantly and geniusly put together. And there isn't a thing that I would change or not want to be there.
Well, let me ask you. I'll ask Rob this, because there is one of the big scenes that everyone talks about is this fight that you two have, and
yes.
So and y'all are very vulnerable in this sequence. So, Rob, I'll ask you: was that when you saw the film put together and that was going to be in there? Were you, did that give you pause? That sequence.
About the fight.
Yeah, the fight and so forth.
Well, we've only had a few fights in our whole friendship.
Right.
And they happened to capture a couple on that recording session, and that was only due to really Lips was under a little extra stress at that time for other reasons, and you know he just mm-hmm. snapped and the cameras were there.
Right. Well, and so when y'all saw a rough cut of this put together. did it exceed your expectations of what this documentary was going to be?
Myself, I was totally blown away. I saw it three times. I was the last one to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew in my heart that it was going to really be an emotional, touching movie to everybody, pull on their heartstrings and all that. But it was really at Sundance where I really was convinced that it really was special, like beyond. When I saw strangers, hundreds of them, just give the movie standing ovations six times in different theaters, I knew the movie was special then, like really special.
Well, what about you, Lips? I mean, what was that like? I mean, that Sundance experience. I mean, this is a film festival. It's a very prestigious American film festival, independent film, and a lot of big stars are there, and a lot of
That was interesting. I was sitting beside Tom Araya from Slayer when at the debut, and he was flipping out. He's going, had I had to go through this, there wouldn't be a Slayer, and I'm sitting there, why? Why would you say that? I mean, pretty amazing, man. What we take for granted, like, as people are, you always do. Rob and I have been friends since we're kids, so we just kind of wonder, why is everybody flipping out about all this? But it is special,
right?
And it has something very, very, very powerful that as the guys in the center of it, it's really hard to get a grasp on how people perceive you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You are who you are, and all this stuff around you. Well, okay.
Let me ask
you. It's real, man.
Yeah.
People.
Let me ask you this. I'm sure. You've been asked this a million times, but I'll try to put it in a different context. Do you guys resent or do you accept kind of the marketing or the critical shorthand when they say stuff like the real life Spinal Tap or something like that?
You know what we're finding more? We're finding that people are more on edge asking us that question than we are in answering it.
Okay,
so Spinal Tap references were there on purpose, couldn't get around it. Rob Reiner, number one. our drummer's name is Rob Reiner.
Right.
So,
with two B's.
With two B's.
You're not going to get around a problem with that. It's a documentary about a rock band. You're not going to get around that.
Heavy metal.
So what you're faced with is either embrace it or look foolish trying to avoid it.
Right.
So why try to look foolish? Embrace it. We happen to be in England. Show us walking around Stonehenge.
Right.
The producer happens to have a piece of equipment that goes to 11. Film it.
I'll ask you this, Rob. When did you first see Spinal Tap, and then you realized, oh, I'm Rob Reiner, and there's a Rob Reiner. When did that occur?
That was well before Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
I was a young kid when Carl Reiner was producing TV shows and.
Right.
And then his son started appearing on, I forget what show it.
The
name, like All in the Family thing was. So my name and Rob Reiner, our names in my life, it's been there my whole life.
Have you,
he's the other Rob Reiner anyways.
Well, I'll ask you this, since you've gone on this press tour and this documentary is really, really becoming a hit with audiences, whoever sees it, have you had a chance to meet Rob Reiner or to meet anyone from Spinal Tap yet?
No, from what we understand, he's a bit disturbed at the fact that there's another documentary out there right now that people are comparing to his,
right.
his masterpiece.
Oh, okay.
And I do call it a masterpiece because it was, man. It's one of the greatest satire right. documentaries ever made. So, you know, we're okay with it. With it, but I guess he's got some issues from what I understand. But that's okay.
And let's be realistic. The Anvil movie is realistically nothing really like Spinal Tap.
Right.
So that's the real bottom line of all.
And the other thing is, the real Marty DeBurgi is Sasha Gervasi.
Right. Well, so so the movie's out. I noticed it was funny, after I saw the film, I went on iTunes. You got three albums on iTunes now. I think Metal on Metal is on there, and a couple others.
This is 13 is going to be released domestically. It'll be there, and more likely our whole back catalog. You know, we are resurfacing here, or surfacing finally after all these years.
Well, yeah. So what's this? I mean, so what's it like? I mean, what are gigs like now? I'm assuming you're getting bigger audiences.
Yeah.
Packed and rocking.
Rocking hard. Like, we're doing the Anvil Experience, which is where we show the movie and then we play right after the movie.
And what about the a new album? When's Anvil?
It's called Juggernaut of Justice, and we're going to record it sometime in the near future. It'll come out later on.
Do you have a producer already? A producer yet?
We're hoping to work with Chris again. We'll see how that works out, but...
Mm-hmm. And
we haven't got anything firmed up. We have the songs written, the album cover. It's all finished, except we just need to record it.
Mm-hmm. So I gotta imagine maybe y'all's philosophy at this point is better late than never, because I mean this seems to be the ride that you've all been hoping for. Is this the ride?
It's
never too late. Would be a better way to put it. This is art.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to art, there is no age.
Right.
Not really, especially metal music. Metal music is timeless. Mm-hmm. Tony Iommi has no problem in playing Paranoid to this day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Well, guys, I want to say congratulations. It's a terrific documentary. It's very moving. It's very funny. And it's also real, it's a heart pumper also. So. Congratulations. I wish you all more success, and I look forward to the new record.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, special thanks to Aaron for doing that interview.
Yeah, that was great. That was a lot of fun listening to those two guys. They're great. I mean,
oh, yeah, they're
a lot
terrific.
Of great stories. They're wonderful.
They're very genuine, and it's actually kind of moving, their journey. Through this movie. It's playing in select cities right now, and I'm sure it'll open wider and eventually be available to watch at home, like every movie ever made.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're hoping for, yes.
Right. So a lot of metal talk, like a lot of music talk in the chat room, I see.
Oh, I know. Julie's like our musical expert, so it's been really great. So she's helping us all out.
She's great with music. I have a limited vocabulary musically, so I'm kind of challenged in that department. I can tell you the third song off the second Barry Manilow album, though. I'm a monster when it comes to that.
Well, that's important, dude. That's very important.
I can't tell you the social situations where that's come in handy. Okay, now we're going to our next interview, and this is interesting. An independent film spotlight. And we're about to bring on the producer of Transformers 2.
Right, I know.
which is something that Chris brought up to me. But actually, he has a new movie out on DVD this Tuesday on the 28th, and it stars Kim Basinger, and it's called While She Was Out, and it's written and directed by Susan Montford, and the producer's name is Don Murphy. He's done some great work, including Natural Born Killers and other high-profile films,
right,
and the first Transformers. So enjoy this interview, Don Murphy, Susan Montford, While She Was Out. What were the movies that inspired you at a younger age and made you think, this is the life for me, filmmaking? Susan, if you want to start out with that.
Oh, there was a lot of them. I mean, because I grew up in the UK, I was lucky enough to only have, like, four channels, and a lot of them played good stuff. So I saw a lot of brilliant movies from an early age. Because they were chosen by tasteful people. And a lot of them were like, I was especially enamored with, you know, films like Miss 45 and Franju's Eyes Without Face, and even the rather, you know, cynical but funny I Spit on Your Grave.
That is a first. I've never heard that as a big influence before.
Me and my friends used to have such a laugh when we watched it, because the revenge is so satisfying and fantastic that it kind of stayed in my head.
Yeah, and all of those play into that film. You can see those influences in there. So, Don, how about you? What moved you as a young man?
King, I'd have to say it was the Irwin Allen 1-2 punch of the Poseidon Adventure and the Towering Inferno, which
wow.
are pure popcorn schmaltz now. But when you're 14 years old and Robert Wagner, knowing he's going to die, leaves his hot secretary in the little cut-off shirt behind, saying, "I'll be right back with the whole fire brigade," and the music swells, and he goes running into the lobby, and it gets burst into flames. Like, oh, that's cool.
That's all you need.
Exactly.
That's great. There, I understand that While She Was Out is based upon a short story. A very short story.
Yeah.
What about? Did you find that short story, Susan? And what about it spoke to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking for a film to direct for any price, you know, like from $1,000 to, you know, $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading a whole bunch of, like, hard-boiled stuff, and I came across this story, and to me it was just perfect, because it had that kind of ballsy heroine, and it had this kind of real-life, relatable situation, and, you know, just lots of very realistic but kind of at the same time quite hard-boiled elements to it, and there was no like really complicated subplots or anything.
Right.
So it seemed to me it would be like really kind of crisp to adapt into a screenplay.
Yeah.
So I was kind of really excited by it.
And Don, you came in pretty early, right, on this project?
Well, Susan had almost directed a film that I was producing in 2002 about the early days of the Manson family. And I had met Susan when she had her short films at the Toronto Film Festival, and I knew she'd make a really good visual director. It was always about finding a project that she was passionate about that, you know, made sense and that you could cast. And, you know, I read the first draft that she gave me of While She Was Out, and it was very, very daring insofar as, you know, if you know anything about movie structure, or even, God forbid, TV structure, there's always an A and a B plot. And in the movie, as you see it now, and even in the first drafts of the script, you're with the Kim Basinger character, Della, from the beginning. There's no B-plot. You never cut back to, like, meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know. It's her story. It's told in kind of quasi, you know, not really like the TV show 24, but quasi real time. And it's really the story of one night, the worst Christmas Eve ever, really. And it's her, she carries the whole movie. I thought that was pretty daring, and when I read it, you know, started working with Susan towards trying to find the right cast for it.
Yeah, and what a great cast you've assembled. And I want to ask about that lead female character and how Kim Basinger just embodies it perfectly, because it has to be incredibly daunting. You never spend a moment away from this character. Did you write it with her in mind?
No,
Susan?
I didn't actually. So it was really interesting when she came on board, because she was unbelievably perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, just everything about her seemed to, you know, translate into the writing somehow, which was very, very strange experience. Because she just, I mean, when I first met with her, she'd read it, and, you know, obviously she's supposedly very shy, and she told me I'm quite shy, so I might not speak much. And then she, like, waxed lyrical about the character for 2 hours. So obviously Della had spoken to her you know, as a person and an actor as well, you know, in quite a deep way.
Yeah, you can see that passion. So you guys had discussions, pre-production, pretty extensive discussions on who this person was?
Yeah, we did. It was a combination of discussing stuff. I mean, we obviously, you know, there was lots of influences that I wanted to talk to her about, you know, like even Little Red Riding Hood, for instance, fairy tales, and, you know, the way she was going to be almost mute, because she hardly speaks, as you see from the movie, so it's going to be very important for her to use her face and her body language. And we talked about how, you know, Bergman's actors all have these amazing ability to convey so much with just a facial expression. And so we looked at some of them, and, you know, we looked at Audrey Hepburn in Wait Until Dark, because she hardly speaks in that. And,
yeah.
You know, we talked about all that stuff, and we got into a lot of depth, but a lot of it was intuitive as well, because it was on the page, and in the script, she had related so much to it that, you know, she kind of got there quite easily.
I notice the technique that you're speaking of. There's an amazing moment she has in this movie where Lucas is taunting her and mentions her children, and just this reaction that she can't hold back without words. It's palpable. It's incredible. And about Lucas, I'm sorry, Lucas Haas is just watching him. And all of his work, but particularly this movie, he seems like an incredibly imaginative actor.
Well, he's extraordinary to work with. He's incredibly malleable, very intelligent, and you kind of just like peel him away like an onion. I mean, when we were talking about, when we were creating Chucky's character, to me, he was really, really multi-dimensional.
Yeah.
And I wanted, as the film progressed, really to see all the different elements of him, from the way he related to his friends to the way he kind of related to the rent-a-cop, and just the way he moved and did stuff until, you know, when he's with her and it's just her and him. It's,
yeah,
he reveals,
yeah,
a whole other aspect of himself. So it was really,
right,
fascinating, you know, creating this character. That I gave him, you know, a lot of films to watch, like, you know, Scum and Made in Britain, you know, because these have, like, very complex, you know, actors and performances in them, and I thought you should check them out just to see what you could play with.
Well, you remember you had a hard time figuring out who you wanted to cast in that role.
Oh, it was very, very difficult, because I actually read so many boys. I must have read about 50 boys, all of hot young actors, and they were never quite right, because they had to be, you know, have the gravitas to take on Kim, so they couldn't be too young. You know, they had to have the intelligence,
yeah,
as well, to be believable, and also to be very boyish, and nobody was doing it for me. And then, and I tried to get in touch with Lucas, and I couldn't find him.
Yeah, you had thought of Lucas,
yeah,
and like you couldn't find his punk ass.
And
then as we were getting down to the wire, I remember it was Guillermo who called and said, what about Lucas?
Yeah, because we were like, I was beginning to panic a little bit as well, and then he brought up Lucas, and so we tried again, and he appeared magically that time. So.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant casting. Don, and I suppose you both can speak to this as well. Tell me what, focusing on this project in particular, what does a good producer do?
Well, the role of a producer really is simple, and although it's very misunderstood, at least a creative producer, which is what we tend to do. Obviously, there's people that do the budgets and people that find the money and blah, 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 blah. But the role of a producer is really to facilitate the director's vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a big metaphor that I use sometimes, although it's very boring, is, you know, the producer has the idea of, you know, building a boat to sail to Cape Town. And then, you know, they work with a director on designing the architecture of the boat, and work with the director on putting them, you know, work with the director and helping the director, who's the captain of the ship, get the boat to Cape Town, if you want to use the simplified metaphor. But, you know, on this particular project, as I knew Susan and I knew how she worked, and I believed in Susan, and I really liked the project, I was supportive and helpful every step of the way, from helping her cast the film, to helping find the financing for the film, to helping make the film, to helping release the film.
Yeah. And are you a producer that likes to be in the trenches, likes to be on the set as much as possible?
Likes to be on the set? I like to be in the trenches.
Yeah.
Not necessarily Mr. Set Producer, although in this particular case, I ended up being so, because it was, you know, it was a really hellish shoot. Susan was amazing for a first timer out there, because it was 29 nights in the rain in Vancouver,
yeah,
in the winter, and you know, it was quite a lot. So that was definitely the trenches.
For this particular kind of genre film, and it seems like you break a lot of rules outside of that genre for this, but if you term it a woman in peril, a woman fights back kind of film, with that mentality, were there traps that you wanted to avoid that are usually associated with those types of films?
Well, I mean, I didn't want to make a film where it's really obvious from the get-go that the heroine's going to really fight back and kick ass.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make her fragile and complex. And
I think that was kind of the key to you casting Kim, too, is that a lot of times you sit down and you go, you know, not that she ever thought of casting Uma Thurman, but it's like if you cast Uma Thurman, there's a residual, like, oh, she's going to kill Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a residual feeling in your mind that she's not in any jeopardy, whereas you've never seen Kim as anything but, like, you know, either beautiful or yeah, vulnerable, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I want you to wonder whether she's going to survive or not until that very moment where she does actually fight back with a vengeance.
Right, right. And what did you learn about yourself during this process? I mean, behind the camera, directing actors, what surprised you about yourself in that role?
I was really surprised at how calm I stayed.
Hmm.
I mean, it was amazing. Like, I found myself being very practical, and even when there was madness and the most horrendous weather and everything all around me, I was able to stay, you know, quite centered and, you know, get the machine through everything.
That's
so
great.
I thought that was interesting because you don't know if you're going to be absolutely hysterical and delirious with fear and anxiety or crippled by it. I mean, you just don't know your first time out, and you obviously worry about that. But,
right.
You know, when push comes to shove and you're in the middle and you've just got to handle everything, I really find that I did.
Yeah, and you've got a great creative team behind you, too, so I'm sure that certainly helped as well.
It's amazing. I had fantastic people. I totally trusted, you know, everybody I was working with as well. And I knew if I didn't know anything, because, I mean, you can't possibly know anything, especially everything, your first
mm-hmm.
time out. So it was really helpful just to be very open with everybody and ask them if I needed their help with something or ask them what they would do, you know. So I didn't, it was really good that way. I was pleased with myself that I could do that as well, because I know some directors get very, very uptight about presenting an image of complete and utter, you know, control and absolute knowledge, and I just didn't go there. I just knew that the way I was going to get through it was I picked great people, I had to get the best out of them and learn as I went along as well.
Yeah. Don, when you watch the finished film, having been through every long process in its creation, when you finally give birth to it and you're able to watch it with an audience, does anything about it surprise you, knowing it as intimately as you do?
I was really impressed by the performances Susan got first time out from, you know, two very talented actors.
Mm-hmm.
I was really impressed by a scene that, aside from myself, every single person that read it said couldn't be done, shouldn't be done, it was impossible, doesn't really work, which was, you know, what we call the 8-minute seduction scene at the end.
Right, right.
Which is just one really, really longest scene in the movie, longer than any movie. Really long scene between two people, one of whom's, you know, hiding, for God's sakes.
Right.
And the number of people, even some of the actors who said, this really isn't going to work, you're not going to use it, you're going to cut it, you're going to do this. And it works brilliantly. You know, little things like that that would, you know, only somebody who's been there from the beginning who would be like, aha, she was right all along, you know, can
yeah.
appreciate.
Yeah. And what's the most satisfying part of this process for you, Susan?
That's a really difficult question to answer, because I guess the satisfying thing is to know that I loved what I did, in terms of I really loved the process. I mean, I loved being on set, working with the actors, and I loved, you know, post, especially doing the music. I'm very pleased with the way the music turned out.
It's great. It's gorgeous.
I feel very lucky, because I actually got the songs I always wanted and that I was thinking of when I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
These two songs, you know, the Joy Division and the Roxy Music.
Well, you had been smart too. She had been smart too as a filmmaker, because we had produced together a film just prior to this called Shoot 'Em Up.
Shoot 'Em Up, yeah.
And she was very smart insofar as some of the key players from that movie, even though this was a budget of like 1/5 that budget, you know, some of the key players from that movie, for example, the visual effects guy and the composer, she had, you know, been smart enough to become very friendly with and get them to work on her film, which then they did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, yeah. Before I let you guys go, you've been so generous with your time. I appreciate it very much. Let me just ask you very quickly about upcoming projects. Don, I guess you have a really big one on the horizon with Transformers 2, correct?
Transformers comes out on June 24th. It does.
Wow. How do you feel as a filmmaker prior to that release in the month or the weeks leading up to the release? Is there adrenaline going on, nerves? How are you feeling?
On this one, probably none, because the question from the first one, from the beginning of even setting the first one up, was, you know, am I insane that this is a good idea, or have I just convinced a lot of people that it's a good idea and it's not?
Right.
And then, you know, when it performed insanely, you know, second biggest movie of the year, it's like, okay, it works.
Right.
In the second one, it's a bigger story, it's a better story, there's more characters, there's more robots. But it's Michael, you know. It's Shire, it's Megan, it's the same people. And so there's no question that it's, you know, when we get to number 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever, and it's a whole kind of like, you know, not necessarily a reboot, but a whole new staff,
right,
then maybe I'll worry again. But I'm not really worried about number 2, because if everybody liked number 1, then there's more love in number 2.
I don't blame you. And you just got a glowing recommendation from Spielberg, I understand. You can't do better than that.
Well, Spielberg's one of the few people that Michael looks up to, so it helps. It helps if Steven likes it, then everybody behind it feels happy. Yes.
Yeah, and Susan, reading about some of the projects you're toying with that you'd like to pursue, really fascinating stuff. There's a Faces of Death film, and you want to return to your Manson family idea as well. Can you tell me a little bit about those two projects?
Certainly. The Faces of Death, actually, Dawn and I are producing together. It's with a young director, J.T. Petty,
mm-hmm.
and he's written a really, really, really good script, which he's just polishing, and then we're hopefully going to get going with that. And with the Manson family, that's been an ongoing fascination for me, obviously, and I was thinking recently that it would just be an amazing TV show.
Yeah.
You know, like The Sopranos.
You have to find somebody supportive of that, huh?
I mean, I'm obviously deranged, but I mean,
yeah, we're not talking about a primetime sitcom. I think we're talking about kind of like a cable HBO kind of conception.
It actually would be a very good idea, but you never have anyone have the balls to do it, so.
Yeah.
I can still have a fantasy about it.
Sure.
And I've also got this other project, which is a Groundhog Day-influenced horror movie.
Well, that's probably the one you're going to direct next.
I'm certainly looking at that. Where a girl that you love to hate gets killed over and over again until she figures out what's going on, and everyone in her life has a motivation to kill her. So it's pretty, it's quite cool, kind of high concept little.
I will be the first in line for that.
Oh, thank you.
That sounds great. Guys, thank you so much for your time. I love the movie, and congratulations on it.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm glad
thank
you enjoyed
you.
It.
Thank you for having us. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Don. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye. Okay, I'm back.
Okay, we were in work there because there was a dead air there, and I was just like,
I'm so sorry. How long was there dead air?
I would say close to a minute.
The switchboard was backing up on me. It wasn't working.
Okay, that's all right. That's okay.
Okay, so that was Don Murphy and Susan Montford. The film While She Was Out comes out on DVD Tuesday the 28th, and it's a great movie. I recommend everyone check it out.
Okay, cool.
So we'll be back Wednesday night. Where we'll have some great guests, I'm sure.
I love that. We'll have some great guests.
Oh yeah. But I appreciate everyone tuning in. If you'd like to contact us or you have any ideas for the show, just email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. We appreciate all your correspondence. And Jerry, I will see you Wednesday night.
Right, yeah, definitely. See you then, man.
All right, buddy.
All right. Have a good night, everyone. Thanks. Thank you.